Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Our guest is Dr. Brian Fallon. He is director of the Lyme and Tick-Borne Disease Research Center at Columbia University, and he's sharing with us the latest in Lyme disease research. In part one, we started talking about why patients don't get better after initial treatment for Lyme disease. You know, standard therapy may be 3 weeks of an antibiotic called doxycycline, but some patients don't get better and they have residual symptoms. And Dr. Fallon is telling us why. So what are a couple more reasons why people might feel stuck and suffer from debilitating symptoms?
Sure. So we talked about persistent Lyme infection. We talked about co-infections, other infections the ticks carry. And another, in the third circle of my four circles of causes, might be a post-infectious immune response that's ongoing, that's no longer due to persistent infections, for example. So in other diseases, we know that you can have antibodies that get triggered, and so strep is a good example. It can cause heart disease. It can cause neurologic disease with antibodies cross-reacting against heart tissue, antibodies that are targeting the strep might also cross-react with neural tissue, causing Sydenham's chorea, or in some children, an obsessive-compulsive type disorder. So we do know, in fact, in Lyme disease, from studies that have been done over the last 10 years, that anti-neuronal antibodies are, in fact, found in these patients with post-treatment Lyme syndrome.
So for a listening audience, an anti-neuronal antibody means that the body is attacking the nerves. It's sort of in an effort to eradicate the Lyme, because Lyme prompts an immune system response. It's kind of like the analogy I sometimes give is, you know, if there's a bank robbery in progress and the police arrive and they start shooting, they might hit some innocent bystanders instead of hitting the perpetrators.
Oh, that's a very good analogy. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, so that is what happens. So you have antibodies that are formed against the Borrelia spirochete, or triggered somehow by the Lyme spirochete invasion, and so the immune system, in a sense, is sort of hyperactivated. So you have these circulating antibodies, and they target nerve tissue, and they can cause peripheral nerve pain or peripheral nerve dysfunction, or they can cause possibly central nervous system dysfunction. So we're still trying to understand exactly what those anti-neuronal antibodies are doing, but what we do know is that they're not there in those who have recovered from Lyme disease. And we also know that other autoimmune illnesses that have circulating antibodies, such as lupus, have a comparable level of antibodies to what you see in these post-treatment Lyme syndrome patients. So that's clearly one possible mechanism for an ongoing persistent symptom.
Which kind of creates a dilemma. Which kind of creates a dilemma, because let's say we assume that someone has had exposure to Lyme disease, but the organism is gone, and they're sort of their immune system's overheated. So we have medicines out there that are designed to treat overactive immune systems. They're so-called cytokine modulating medications. They use them for psoriasis, ulcerative colitis, MS, lupus. So we put a patient on an immune suppressant medication in an effort to curb their symptoms. But what if indeed they still have Lyme organisms in their body?
Yeah.
And you suppress their immune system, the Lyme could suddenly explode, right?
Now that's an exactly correct point, which is that's the concern. If you give something that quiets down or over-modulates the immune response, and it's no longer as effective in monitoring the body for infection, and allows a sequestered or a quiescent infection to suddenly get out of control, that's a concern. So there has been a reluctance among patients, certainly, to try those medications. I don't actually know of any research that has yet been conducted using those medications.
It would be tough to get approval for something like that.
Yeah, it would be challenging. It would be challenging, which is why we need a test of active infection,
so that
we can start doing those other studies.
That would really help.
There is a form of it. Yeah, I mean, there is a treatment that is being used clinically by some physicians, neurologists, and immunologists, intravenous gamma globulin therapy, because that's been shown to be helpful for patients, for example, who have autoimmune neuropathies.
Okay.
What's nice about that is that it actually does not damp down your ability to fight off infection. So unlike the other immune modulating agents, this does not put you at risk of activating a quiescent infection. So that actually is being tried clinically among patients, and there was a report in the American Academy of Neurology, a poster session, I think it was in 2009, by Dr. Katz, showing that at least in his open label treatment, it looked like the IVIG was helpful for the patients with neuropathic symptoms associated with Lyme. So I think that's something that should very well be studied, because now there's some preliminary data on it. IVIG is used for a lot of different disorders. And then the fourth circle in my circle of causes of persistent symptoms would be neural dysregulation. So an area of the mechanisms of disease that's sort of often somewhat overlooked is the brain. And what we know in other diseases is that the pain pathways, for example, can get hyperactivated by various environmental triggers, whether it's an infection or physical trauma, injury. And once the pain networks are hyperactivated, it may no longer be true that an antibiotic would resolve that, but it likely would require something that's directly targeting those hyperactive neural circuits. And that could be, for example, medications that work on modulating norepinephrine or the glutamate system. It could be direct current stimulation. For example, I know in some rehabilitation centers, they're using magnetic stimulation therapies for patients who have persistent brain fog, for example. So right now at Columbia, we have a nice study with my colleague, Dr. Landa, where we're giving patients, everybody's getting what's called an SNRI, which is a serotonin, norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor.
Like a Lexapro kind of medication?
Well, no, not so much Lexapro, but things like Cymbalta and... we're using something that the trade name is Savella, which is the generic is milnacipran, but it works on both serotonin and norepinephrine, whereas Lexapro primarily focuses serotonin. And the key is the norepinephrine, because what's been shown is that when you can modulate the norepinephrine function in the brain, you can often help to decrease pain syndromes, whether it's arthritic pain or neuropathic pain. And the idea is that we need to quiet down these hyperactive pain pathways. So that's one of the studies we're doing right now. We're doing fancy brain imaging before and after, and then we're adding a glutamate modulator in the middle of the study, D-cycloserine, to see if that will add further benefit.
That's an antibiotic, actually, that has been used kind of off-label for treatment of...
You're really sharp. Not that many people know that yeah. was... and it's a very old tuberculosis antibiotic.
Yeah.
That's right.
But it has other, not just antibiotic properties, it has some neuromodulatory properties.
It's one of the more powerful glutamate modulators. And glutamate is of great interest in neuropsychiatry. Ketamine, for example, is a glutamate modulator that has been shown to be a very powerful treatment for patients with refractory depression. It's been used as... in pain clinics throughout the country, actually, to help people who have persistent pain. And the problem with ketamine is that it can cause a number of adverse effects when used on an extended basis. So everybody's looking for safer alternatives.
It's a street drug. It's a drug of abuse, actually. You know,
So that's why we're using D-cycloserine. Yeah.
Right. Okay, so it all comes back to... You know, it's obviously about better therapies, but it still comes back to our ability to discern who has chronic Lyme disease and who has these other related problems. And so can you give us, our listeners, just a basic primer on how to test for Lyme disease and, you know, the pros and cons of some of the tests that are out there?
Sure. So the standard tests are antibody-based tests, which means that your immune system generates these markers called antibodies that then attack the bacteria when they come into your body. So one is called the first screening test that's often used is called the ELISA. According to the CDC, if that's negative, you stop there. If it's indeterminate or positive, you go on and order a Western blot just to try to refine the test further to see whether it's a true positive or a false positive. Many doctors, including myself, order both the Western blot and the ELISA, and I do that because about 10% of the time a negative ELISA might actually have a fully positive IgG Western blot. So the testing, unfortunately, is not perfect at all. So in the first 3 weeks of infection, for example, the test may be completely negative. And the studies have shown that about 50% of the patients test positive early in disease. Well, a test that only detects 50% of the patients is obviously a terrible test. Later on, for patients, at least with Lyme arthritis, it becomes a much better performing test. And with neurologic Lyme disease, it's a moderately good test, but again, it still misses anywhere maybe 10 to 30% of cases. So when you have a test that isn't 95 or 99% sensitive, you've got a problem. And then the additional problem of these antibody tests is they don't tell you if you have active infection.
Right.
So there's the ELISA and the Western blot. Now, some people say, well,
and the Western blot is kind of a little bit like reading tea leaves. It's sort of like, you know, you got a 3 of 5 or 2 out of 3, and it's, you know, like, and then what if you have like 1, and that's a little suggestive, but it's not quite meeting the criteria, but the patient feels
exactly
sick as a dog.
Right. And, you know, that's a little bit arbitrary, too. So
yeah.
They like to see, well, you know, when the CDC adopted these criteria for surveillance purposes, they adopted them to so that they could monitor the course of disease over time in a very objective, clear, reproducible way. And for that purpose, the test is fine. I mean, it's reproducible. It may not detect all the cases of Lyme, but at least it tells you the change from year to year if you're using the same test. The problem is, as you say, it's like a tea leaf. So let's say the CDC said that you have to have 5 out of 10 bands. Well, what if you have 4 bands? Does that mean that you don't have, that you didn't have exposure to the Lyme spirochete? And certainly it would be read as a negative test by many labs. And when I look at that, I'm thinking, 4 bands, that's quite a few bands. So my mind is still a little bit suspicious.
So what about PCR? You were talking about PCR. Now, PCR, for our listeners, is, you know, if you watch, you know, the special on OJ in, you know, the 1980s, that was the early DNA technology. You know, it's like if you got DNA on the glove, you know, then you did it. And PCR is polymerase chain reaction technology, which amplifies tiny, tiny amounts of DNA. So these are like a tiny vestige of DNA of a Lyme tick in your system, then it's suggestive that, you know, something's going on. So what and people use that sometimes for diagnosis. Is there a problem with that?
If it comes back positive, that's very informative because it tells you that you've got the DNA of the spirochete, and that's almost as good as growing out the spirochete in culture, which is very hard to do. So if you do have a positive PCR, that's fortunate, and it tells you that you probably have active infection. The problem is, once again, that early in, it's just an insensitive test. So even at the time when you're most likely to have a huge amount of spirochetes floating in your system, which is right after the tick bites you, and you have right at the time of the rash before you've been treated, the PCR test may be positive 40% of the time, 50% of the time, so it's not sufficiently sensitive. And then later in the course of disease, let's say you haven't even been treated yet, but the spirochete may have disseminated to your spinal fluid or to your joints or deep into muscle tissue. It's no longer in your blood, and so you may not be able, will not be able to see the DNA, so it'll come back negative.
So you're saying that there could be false negatives, but also is there a possibility of a false positive? In other words, if it's positive, it's pretty clear that you have an ongoing infection, or could it be a residual of an infection that got handled already?
Yeah, that's Well, you could have a false positive because you have a lousy lab doing the test.
That's true.
For
okay.
Reason, you have a false
contamination
positive.
Or something.
Contamination, right? Or you could have a positive that merely indicates, as you say, that the spirochete was there, let's say, recently, and it's just pieces of its DNA hanging out in the body. Now, I'm not a microbiologist, as you know, and I have spoken to numerous microbiologists asking this very same question, and the essential point is, how long does this remnant DNA stay in the body after the spirochete is gone or dead? And the majority of people answer the question and say within hours or days, but there are some others who say it can last much longer. So I pay attention when there's a positive DNA result from a good lab.
Okay. Okay, so then there are tests where you can do spinal taps. That's no fun, by the way, but it's a very invasive, unpleasant test to have done. And there's proposals that this or that or the other special protein can give you insight as to whether it's a chronic Lyme infection, but that's still half-baked. It hasn't been shown conclusively.
Yeah, there are, just to go to address both of your points, this spinal fluid is, like, enormously valuable. I love when patients actually have had a spinal tap, and the reason I love that is because then at least you have a picture of what's going on in that what should be clear fluid of the surrounding the brain. That's the closest we can get to actually studying the brain is the spinal fluid, at least in terms of looking for microbes. So if you see elevated white cells or elevated protein or if you have antibodies against Lyme in there, that's enormously helpful. It's not as terrible a test as you said. It doesn't hurt much when it's getting inserted because there's an anesthetic there, and I think it's really unfortunate that patients aren't getting more spinal taps, but I know the whole notion of a spinal tap.
It's yucky.
It's unappealing.
Yep.
It sounds barbaric to stick a needle in. So anyway, I recommend it for patients, but most of the patients I recommend it to choose not to do it.
Right.
Then there's the issue of the newer tests that are being developed. And I would say that, as you said, there are protein-based tests or that look at specific markers that might be present, let's say, in the urine. There was one that recently is published from George Mason University that looks promising. But all these tests need to be replicated and studied further. There are some interesting tests that look at what are called stimulation assays, where you take, let's say, cells from the blood and you stimulate those cells with, let's say, a piece of the spirochetal protein, and you look to see how strong is the immune response produced by that monocyte or macrophage, that immune cell, against the spirochete that you've just exposed it to. And if that cell had recently seen a spirochete or a Lyme spirochete, then it would produce a robust amount of, let's say, a cytokine like IL-1 beta. If it hasn't recently seen it, it will produce a lower amount.
Okay.
So there are people working and companies working on developing that those assays as well, which are promising because that may be a test of active infection.
There's a test looking at a type of complement. It's a C4A that has been proposed as a test to show activity, but I suspect it's a test that might be elevated with other conditions as well.
That's right. So the C4A complement marker is one test that people look at. It's more of a general test of an infectious marker, really. There's another one out there that patients and some physicians use, the CD57 immune marker, which it's a natural killer cell marker. I don't actually like that test because I looked in a in my Lyme patients and in my healthy controls to see what the CD57 marker was, and it was really all over the place. Some people were low who were healthy, some people who had Lyme were very sick, had normal levels. So in my mind, it's not a useful test.
So we need better tests, bottom line, and there are, there's
absolutely
kind of a space race, various labs, companies working towards providing us with an answer that will help guide our therapies.
Yeah. I mean, that is the great news, which is, the bad news is that there are 300,000 cases of Lyme disease each year. The good news is that there are so many cases of Lyme disease that entrepreneurs and industry is recognizing that there's an opportunity both to help patients and to make money by developing the next best Lyme test. So there is a great rush to do that, both to help the patients as well as for capitalism reasons.
Do you think that Lyme disease is more or less prevalent than it's said to be? Because, you know, some people claim that, you know, virtually any form of fatigue, malaise, arthritis might be hidden Lyme disease, or conditions like ALS and MS, the high percentage of those might be infectious in origin. And there are others who say, no, we should stick to very strict criteria, and if you don't show a positive on these tests, don't even go there.
Yeah. Well, that's an excellent question. And there's both overdiagnosis in the Lyme world, and there's underdiagnosis. If you look at the history of Lyme, which I'm going to give it to you in 2 minutes.
Sure.
I would say the first 15 years from like 1975 to 1990 were a time of discovery and openness, and people were describing all the different manifestations of fairly well-documented patients who had, let's say, spinal fluid abnormalities consistent with Lyme. And some of those patients did have atypical presentations, whether it was an MS-like presentation or a, for example, obsessive-compulsive disorder type presentation. And then in the 90s, so the next 15 years, let's say to 2005, things, for good reasons, became more carefully codified. And the good reason was for national surveillance. So you needed to have objective criteria, clinical criteria, and you needed to have objective laboratory criteria so that the surveillance could be consistent and reliable. And, you know, the CDC never intended for these criteria and standards to be used as the sole arbiter of whether someone had Lyme disease, but clinicians start to use it that way. And partly that contributed to the controversies and conflicts and the headaches.
And insurance companies get into the act, too, because they are into cost containment, and they will sometimes use these strict criteria to refuse the underwriting of some of these complex, long-term, expensive treatments.
That's right. And if you look, you know, and it was not uncommon for prominent academics in the mid-90s and early 2000s to say that our diagnostic tests are 100% accurate. And we know they're not 100% accurate, but now it's widely recognized they're not 100% accurate. So I would say that since 2005 or 2008 to the present, we've had a renewed spirit of openness in the academic community about studying patients who have persistent symptoms to try to really figure out why. And the exciting thing is that because of precision medicine and the whole omics revolution, where we can do genomics and proteinomics and metabolomics, all these different omics, we can drill down and look to see what's going on in the blood, what's going on in the spinal fluid, how are recovered patients different from persistently ill patients, and whether it's persistent infection or immune dysregulation or neural dysregulation, patients don't care. They just want to get better.
Mm-hmm.
So what I see as a remarkable hopeful thing for patients is that preeminent scientists around the country are really focusing on these exciting and important questions.
And what's your take, in conclusion, on some of the natural therapies that are bandied about for Lyme disease? Does natural support with nutrients, diet modification, herbal treatments, acupuncture, yoga, relaxation, do they have a place?
I would say absolutely they have a place. Do I know exactly how huge a place? I don't. I mean, unfortunately, I don't know of any carefully conducted studies that have looked at these. So we're doing our first controlled study of yoga and meditation with a clinician up in Southport, Connecticut, Dr. Alexander, and he very generously actually is donating his time to do this study. But that's the first that I know of in terms of yoga for Lyme disease as a study. I don't know anybody who's really carefully studied nutrients. I do know that, you know, acupuncture is very helpful for a lot of patients, and it's been shown to be helpful with in other disease situations, and certainly patients in my office report acupuncture being very helpful, so I would think that it is. But it would be wonderful to be able to study these other approaches more carefully.
Right. So what's, in conclusion, what's today's Intelligent Medicine call to action? A couple of things. First of all, you are involved in research. I don't know if you are a clinician seeing patients one-on-one. Some people, after hearing your erudite discussion, might say, hey, I'm going to zoom up to Columbia and get this figured out. Do you treat patients, or does your center evaluate patients to make recommendations on where they should go?
Yeah, we do. And we have a central screening number I can give you where we can tell people about the research studies, and we can tell them about if they don't want to participate in a research study, they can have a clinical evaluation with us. You know, that number is 646-774-7503.
And there's a website.
And the website is terrific, and we there's a lot of information.
Columbia-Lyme.org, if I'm not mistaken.
Columbia-Lyme.org.
Okay. And then there's also a Lyme Foundation that you're involved with, which is dedicated towards expanding some of this research so that we get better answers.
Yeah, so the Global Lyme Alliance just had their major fundraiser, and now, our Lyme Center at Columbia was started by two major national organizations, the Lyme Disease Association and the Global Lyme Alliance. This is the first center really devoted and focused to patients with chronic symptoms in a medical center in the United States. So I'm grateful to both of those organizations. And actually, one thing I just want to tell you is and share with the audience is that I'm profoundly grateful to mothers and fathers and patients who have mobilized and organized to both support education efforts and research efforts, because what they've done has made a huge difference.
Yeah, it's a grassroots movement, because it's one of these medical conditions that's prevalent, but not on the order of breast cancer or Parkinson's disease or something, which has which is got celebrity underwriters and huge foundations behind it.
The National Institute is really underfunded and for Lyme disease research. I mean, in terms of supporting it, the funding levels, even though the incidence of Lyme disease in the United States has gone up progressively over the last 25 years, funding levels per individual case actually have gone down.
Indeed. So it's globallymealliance.org. One word, globallymealliance.org, where you can find out about how to get involved. It's a great organization. And I'm glad to see that they're helping to support your efforts, because, I've followed your work through the years, and you're really one of the good guys in the fight against Lyme, trying to come up with better strategies, reasonable strategies in this very difficult, very challenging, complex disorder. So thanks for joining us.
I appreciate your comments, and I really appreciate your questions. They were excellent.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm just being a proxy for what's on the mind of our Intelligent Medicine listeners, and they're astute listeners, and they want answers. Thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Brian Fallon. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Mm-hmm.